You're recording at 11:30 a.m. and this is Pacific Summer Time. Well, this is also Friday, so it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And really, this has been a very tumultuous week in just about all stock markets and indeed in commodities. So, well, when we look at all of this, we need to sort of think about it more in terms of the medium and long-term perspective. I had an email today asking whether these short-term or medium-term top formations that we have in a number of stock market indices represent the end of a secular bull market. And I think this is a very important delineation to make, so it's been particularly relevant for the long-term view. Secular means extraordinarily long-term. In other words, it could be upwards of 20 years. And what we've had over the last 6 years has been an incredibly impressive medium-term rally, or a cyclical bull within a secular bull market environment. A lot of it has been predicated on access to abundant liquidity, which has been made available by extraordinary measures by an increasing number of central banks. Well, the Fed's quantitative easing program ended last September, and then what we have is that the S&P 500 began to lose uptrend consistency from October with a sharp pullback and then an even sharper rebound, but then a loss of momentum, which has been in evidence for much of the last 7 months. Well, something that we talk about a lot in the chart seminar is that ranges are explosions waiting to happen, that a range is a decision-making process, and that it thins out supply above and demand below the market, and that creates vacuums. Eventually, the vacuum will be penetrated, and then you'll get a breakout. And in this case, the breakout is to the downside, and that has been a risk that we've been signaling in almost every audio for the last 2 months as being a potential possibility here, an increasing possibility, considering that we've had such an incredible amount of single stock volatility over the last number of months. And the way to think about that single stock volatility is, you know, when you look at something like Biogen, which has a history of becoming overextended relative to the 200-day moving average, and then it pulls back, and you know, and that pullback can be really quite large in terms of the consistency of the trend, that it could be upwards of 20%. But then it was pulling back and finding support in the region of the moving average, and it did that again earlier this year, and then it came out with earnings and just fell straight through the support overnight. And without a stop in the market, then one would be sitting on a potential loss, and even with a stop, then the chances of being executed at a favorable level are virtually zero. Well, that didn't really affect anybody with an ETF position, but if you had a single stock position, then you would have been underwater, or you're really heavily impacted very, very quickly, which is really deleterious to sentiment. And by the same token, then Google is surging to the upside on its earnings, Amazon surging to the upside on its earnings, then it wouldn't have affected you if you had an ETF, but if you had the single stock position, then you would have been in a very favorable position really very, very quickly. And that if you wanted to buy, then you would have been buying in after a massive surge. And then that's not exactly the most favorable time to be buying. So then you're really very susceptible to any kind of weakness. And these are issues that are very relevant to single stock investors. And because of the just ballooning market for ETFs, and they haven't really been an issue for a number of index investors. But the reality is that any market will trade on the margin, and new potential sources of demand in any market represent, you know, the bullish factors behind in advance. And when you get one section of investors getting hit or getting their sentiment impacted, well, then that tends to lead to losses of momentum because you're withdrawing sources of demand. Well, that's exactly what we've had on the S&P. It's down an additional 90 points today, and it's the Nasdaq is down 90 points. The S&P is down 29 points for almost a 100-point decline this week, and it's trading below 2,000 on the futures. Well, that 2000 level represents an area of potential support, and there is a short-term oversold condition, so we could get a bounce next week, which would help to unwind it. But considering that we've had the breakdown from the range, and now we're below the 200-day moving average, then it really is for the bulls to prove here, and you would need an emphatic upward dynamic to really check the potential for a further test of underlying trading. Well, it isn't just the S&P. The Dow Jones has been leading on the downside, and it hit a new reaction low yesterday, and it has a progression of lower rally highs for the last 2 months. And the Russell 2000, looking really ropey last October, rallied right back up and moved to new all-time highs and then failed, and has now pulled back again and is breaking downwards in here today. Again, this is not bullish action, but it's not bullish in the short term. And it potentially represents medium-term top formation development. We certainly have evidence of that on at least some of these indices. But it would be rash to say that this is the end of a secular bull market, because we've really only broken out of a 13-year range in the last 18 months to 2 years. And that when one looks at history, and particularly the period between 1965 and 1980, then they also had an emphatic upward break. And that index pulled all the way back to test the upper side of the underlying range. Well, the top of the underlying range for the S&P 500 is 1600, and that would be a 20% decline from where we are right now. And there's no reason to believe that we're going to get that large a pullback, but this is a corrective phase, and we are overdue a 10% pullback on these markets. We haven't seen one in a number of years, and that does raise then the possibility that this is at least a short-term top, potentially a medium-term top, but unlikely to be a long-term top, and that we're going to be queued up for a very favorable buying opportunity perhaps later this year. There's been an incredible amount of uncertainty with regard to what exactly is the Fed going to do, and the sentiment now is down to about 30% that they're going to raise interest rates in September, and with the stock market pulling back in this sort of panicky fashion, then one would have to conclude that it's rather unlikely that they're going to raise interest rates here. Against that background, does one really need to own the US dollar? Well, the dollar has been weak in here, and the euro is stronger by over a full cent, and the yen is stronger by over a full yen. Those are the two carry trade currencies of choice that their central banks, both the Bank of Japan and the ECB, are engaged in aggressive monetary easing. They have zero interest rates and relatively easy credit conditions, so that it's very easy to borrow those currencies and invest them in higher yielding or markets that have got the capacity for capital appreciation. The outperformance of the euro indices over the last, well, particularly in the first 3 to 4 months of this year, was in lockstep with the depreciation of the euro. So people were borrowing euro and investing it in European equities, and that worked and was a really very favorable trade for the beginning of the year. But the euro has stopped going down. In fact, it's starting to go back up. It's at 113.5, and the low was around 105. Well, it's still unwinding the oversold condition relative to the 200-day moving average, and you really would need a clear downward dynamic to question potential for this to go higher here and at least test the 115 level. Well, you look at, for example, the Euro stocks or the German DAX, and they've pulled back very sharply this week. They are now coming back into potential areas of support. Well, certainly the Euro stocks hasn't been the most consistent trend in the world, and with an inconsistent trend like this, which has been susceptible to really quite large pullbacks, then you have to give it a bit more room. You have to think more in terms of the medium-term progression of higher reaction lows, and that also means that the position sizes have to be smaller because it's not a particularly consistent trend. Well, the DAX has been considerably more consistent, and not least because it's a total return index. But it's back to now the psychological 10,000 point level. Well, it may find support here, and this is a potential area of support, because it's coming back to this area, which had been an area of resistance before and could potentially be an area of support on this occasion, but we've no evidence yet that that could potentially be the case. When we look at the broader picture, the dollar had been going down for a very long time, and then we had this really very impressive rally by the dollar, not least because the euro had gone down, but also because commodity trade related currencies have been so strong for so long and are now unwinding all of that, and that emerging market currencies, which had done spectacularly well because of the weak dollar environment, those trades are also being unwound. Well, it is in the fact that now we're also getting commodity prices that are just not recovering. And oil prices, well, WTI traded below $40 today. Now, it's probably not going to close below $40, but this is a depressed environment, and it's actually a new low for the reaction. Well, copper is down a bit more in here today, but, you know, it's probably the industrial metal that has held on to the majority of its gains, and or held on to more of its gains over the secular bull market period than some of those other ones. So it's not a particularly bullish environment there either. Well, when we look at these commodities and we look at commodity currencies and emerging market currencies, there's a broad picture of commonality that they're all weakening in here. And part of the reason for that is because for the previous 10 years, we had an environment where the US dollar was getting weaker, and it was in the interests of the USA to have a weak currency. Well, you know, there's no country wants a strong currency, but there's competition for who needs a weaker currency more than others, and the USA needed a weaker currency. Well, it's arguable whether that is still the case, that the Eurozone needs a weak currency, and the Japanese need a weak currency, and increasingly the Chinese need a weak currency. But emerging markets compete with a number of these, would certainly compete with Japan, and certainly compete with China. So if they're weakening their currencies, then it's setting up this competitive environment. It means then that one really does need to look at the value of the currency before we invest. I posted a number of currency, or US dollar denominated charts for Malaysia, Indonesia, and Thailand yesterday, because the impact of the currency depreciation in there is really quite considerable, and it means then that it's unlikely that foreign investors are going to be encouraged back into these markets until they have some kind of confidence that they're going to be able to get both capital appreciation and currency appreciation and an attractive yield, because that's exactly what they've been used to over the last 10 years. Now, they might get the yield and they might get the capital appreciation over the next 10 years, but that the dollar might be weakening right now, but that this is looking more like a consolidation at the beginning of a new secular bull market, that the US dollar is unlikely to be going down in the same way that it has done for the previous decade. And this means then that we're in a more volatile environment for currencies, and this isn't something that's likely to change, that in fact is probably going to get worse. It also means that commodity-related markets, and Kazakhstan yesterday was an example, that they're unlikely to be able to continue to hold their dollar pegs at these levels when commodity prices have declined so much. Well, oil prices have been weak now for the better part of a year. And I see news today that Mexico has locked in a price of, I think it was something like $50 for next year's production, whereas it had been more like $75 for their previous fixing, or the rate at which they were selling futures. Well, you know, that's the kind of move that has, you know, pretty significant impacts on government finances. It means then that the potential for currency market volatility is likely to really remain very much the case. But at the present moment, what we have is a dollar that is continuing to unwind its overbought condition. And it means then that we've had accelerated declines in some of these commodity currencies and emerging market currencies. Well, we haven't any evidence just yet that that is over, and not least because what I saw one person describe as a dirty peg that the yuan has now entered relative to the US dollar is likely to remain a focus for such a considerable number of countries in China's hinterland that there is absolutely no way that China's neighbors can afford to allow their competitiveness to erode, and that means that they're going to have to devalue their currencies if China is allowing the yuan to depreciate. And despite the fact that China has really made waves in the last week, the yuan has been getting weaker for a year, and that this is only the latest iteration of what remains a medium-term move, and that we can anticipate that a decade or more process of yuan appreciation is over. That even if they do move to a more market-based way of allowing to set the value of their currency, that will be used by anyone who wants to express a view on China as a liquid market in which to express their views. And it means then that there's no reason why the renminbi should be getting stronger, unless we have very clear evidence of economic superiority. And we can argue that that China has made just remarkable progress in developing a services sector, but we're still a long way from developing the kind of, or from seeing China develop the kind of reporting mechanisms that people can have faith in and really then come up with a really good idea of what fundamental value entails. Well, when we think about the long term, then technological innovation, the rise of the global middle class, and when we think about the way that energy prices have come down, these are just powerful bull market points. Well, technological innovation isn't going to be impacted one way or the other by the fact that we've hit a near-term or medium-term peak. And sorry about that, the phone ringing. What we have then is that we're in an environment where the global middle class is under pressure. And this is one of the reasons why we're moving into a position where the stock market is pulling back in here. This isn't that we have incredibly low energy prices, or at least the lowest energy prices anyone has seen in a long time. And it's been our view that there's little prospect of the $100 level being tested for oil prices anytime soon, and it would really require a significant political deterioration in the Middle East to do that. And considering that we have just a remarkable innovation in renewable energy, in solar technology, in artificial photosynthesis, and increasingly in nuclear technology, that we're moving into a period of time where there's going to be abundant energy for just about anything that anyone could possibly wish for. And that's a powerful enabler for a secular bull market. Well, we're also getting back to an area where this is a period of technological innovation that could only be described as a golden age. It certainly helped the energy sector, and it's been transformative for the biotechnology sector, and that's likely to persist. That we're really getting now the realization of many of the the promises that were made for the internet age. Well, governance is where it's all at in terms of the rise of the global middle class. We're in the next 30 years, we're going to have more people alive than have ever been alive before. And you could even make an argument on a cumulative basis that that's true. But for those people to reach their productive capacity, then we need to see governance improving. And in many places, we can say that that is the case. But falling commodity prices are showing us, you know, that, for example, in Brazil, that they haven't made the kinds of advances in their standards of governance that would really be required to set them on a road to long-term prosperity. And until they can successfully impeach Dilma Rousseff and appoint a reform-minded administration, then they would have to question whether that's even possible. Well, China's continuing to move through this period of transition, and it's just incredibly volatile. Well, the stock market is now back to where we would expect it to find support. That this is exactly where, if they are going to continue to support the market, that it should bounce. But the question remains as to how effective that can be. That the level they chose to support is comparatively high, and their job would have been a lot easier if they had picked a lower level. The fact that you have this renminbi volatility is something that is going to act as a headwind to their supports for the stock market. Well, the Hong Kong market is really quite oversold at this stage. And when we look at, for example, the pullbacks that we've had in Europe or on Wall Street, well, Hong Kong has pulled back much more sharply, and it probably has the deepest oversold condition of any that there is out there. And valuations are about as low of any developed market as one could possibly wish for. So there is the potential that we're going to get a bounce in there, but that what's going to happen after that will be the big question. This is an uncertain environment, and the fact that we're getting the euro and the yen starting to rally in here suggests that some people are beginning to take some of their money off the table. The VIX index hasn't been really an attractive or even a useful measure for volatility for quite some time. But it did pop to the upside in here. It's currently trading around 23. That's about as high a level as we've seen since about December. And the high that it got to in October was about 30. But even then, those are depressed levels. And what we have now is a short-term oversold condition, so there is the potential for a bounce in here. But the question then is, who's going to be the first person to buy a new high following this rather extreme pullback? That confidence will most definitely have been challenged, and a lot of people are now nervous about what the eventual normalization of interest rates will bring. Well, it means then that this could potentially give us an opportunity to pick up favorable investments, those that will benefit from lower oil prices, those that benefit from technological innovation, and those that benefit from the on average higher standard of living that people have all over the world. That what we have is a more difficult environment in terms of currencies right now. But just as it's the best time to hedge a currency is before the depreciation, the best time to become bullish of a currency is after the depreciation. And a number of these emerging market currencies have fallen so much that we must be getting towards a position where there is potential for support. And we don't have evidence of that just yet, but we are certainly getting towards those types of levels. When we look at Wall Street and we take the very long-term perspective, then the potential is that we could have a ranging environment on Wall Street for upwards of a couple of years, where this 6-year bull market consolidates above the 13-year trading range. It certainly wouldn't be the first market that consolidates following a breakout. We've seen that on numerous occasions. And provided that does indeed occur, then we'll have absolutely no reason to question the bull market hypothesis. And that's as true of Wall Street as it is of much of Europe, even though Europe has been lagging by a considerable margin. That when we get these major pullbacks, and so far this was a difficult week, but the S&P, as I speak, is down approximately 2.76% for the year, and that suggests that a lot of people have not experienced real profit erosion yet if they're investing in index products. We could quite easily be moving into this the long-awaited 10% pullback that we've been warning of for quite some time, but that is really just a short-term consideration when you look at what the potential outcome could be over the next 20 to 30 years, and it really means that we're being queued up for what could be a very favorable buying opportunity. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend. I wish all the best to all of you.